Jeremy Thorney.
Now, for those of you who got the two dot sticker and don't know what to do with it, I noticed this trend a couple of weeks ago when we started appearing, is people would sticker off and stick it to their noses, and they called us the pig nose. Get someone to take a picture and then look at the flicker. I'm not sure why this is a popular thing to do, but I've seen people do this quite a bit. So. Anyway, as you heard, I'm Jeremy Thorney from Yahoo, and I inadvertently stole the title of my talk from the open source conference that's going to be in Portland in a few weeks. This was a subconscious thing. I thought it was a great idea for a name for a talk because I had some ideas I didn't want to talk about. You submitted it, and then I was looking at the website for OSCON, and I was like, oh, I think I stole the title of my talk from these guys. So hopefully they won't mind. Who am I? I've been a long time Yahoo, which apparently long time nowadays means you've been at the company more than 3 years. The reality is, when I started 5.5 years ago, it was a third of the size it is now. We've got quite a number of employees. I spent my first 3 years in Yahoo Finance, then spent a year as our sort of in-house MySQL guru, doing support and training, infrastructure, help, and things like that. And then I moved into Yahoo Search about a year ago, which is where I am today. I'm also a blogger at Weblog. The URL is basically my name slash blog. And I'm the author of an O'Reilly book called High Performance MySQL that just happens to be for sale at the O'Reilly booth here. I actually didn't know they were selling it, so I'm thrilled. It's great. Go buy a copy. That's sort of me in a nutshell. So for sort of the setting and the mindset of this talk, I don't want to get into religious debates or what's open and what's free and things like that, but sort of the mentality of what's open nowadays, when I think of looking to the future, how things today that we see on the internet are, I think, signs of what we're going to see more of in the future. Some of it is the real basic stuff that we've had for a long time. I mean, the reason the web, one of the reasons the web is as popular as it is because the early browsers had this view source command, which meant that you could learn how to do this stuff by looking at what other people did, taking their code, and then seeing what effects, what changes had to it. That's how a lot of people learned the Blink tag, I'm sure. And it worked for HTML, it works for JavaScript, and being able to do that, I think, has been great for the spread of web technology and really getting people into a tinkering mindset when it comes to learning this stuff. I mean, I learned to program years and years ago by copying program listings out of magazines onto my Commodore 64 with the tape drive, and then making changes to the code to see how it worked. And it was a lot more tedious back then, let me tell you. Open source, of course, is open. All the web technology that's going into building web applications today, everything from the low-level stuff in the operating system to the high-level scripting languages, is all open source. It's all freely available. And it's really what makes a lot of this stuff go nowadays. The same thing is true of more and more of the clients on the desktop side. Firefox, I think, is the best example of that, with something close to 10% market share nowadays, and quite a bit more when you start looking at technology-heavy websites. You know, I've heard reports of 30%, 40%, 50% of traffic being from Firefox now. And then the internet infrastructure itself primarily is all open technology, all open standards. The only example I could think of that had any sort of real administration and process over it that didn't make it easy for someone else to get in was DNS, which is sort of centralized by nature because it just has to be. But that's only on the server side. On the client side, anyone can query DNS and get what they need back. So, by and large, the internet infrastructure itself was created in an open fashion. It supports all these sort of applications we're seeing in the future. One disclaimer I should make, I guess, I'm actually not going to talk a lot about what we've done at Yahoo because I think a lot of that isn't terribly new. If this was earlier in the year, I'd talk about what we're doing with the developer network. If you do want to check it out, look at developer.yahoo.com. You can see all of our APIs and the cool stuff we're doing there. I'm more interested in what some of the trends we're seeing nowadays are and what I think they point to in the future. And one of those trends is sort of the rise of APIs, which you've been hearing about. You know, we've seen this with a lot of large companies. We've seen this with the BBC now with Backstage. And I actually think there's two different things when I think of APIs. One is the traditional APIs where you are querying a remote service and getting a response back in XML that has been spec'd out to some degree. And, you know, we've got our developer network, eBay, PayPal have theirs, Amazon has one, Google has one, BBC is working on that. But there's also the whole syndication world, RSS and Atom, that primarily is being pushed out now for blogging. I mean, blogging, to some degree, has really been the thing that's made RSS incredibly popular. But I think RSS's applications can go far, far beyond what we're seeing today with simple syndication of the personal weblogs and things like that. For a long time now, there's been this notion of having this sort of semantic web, or this machine-readable web, where computers can talk to each other and freely exchange data in XML. And this was the promise ever since XML was invented. But if you look at what's happened, the only really big success story with machine-to-machine communication over some XML standard has been RSS. And RSS isn't exactly that standard. There's like 8 variations of RSS out there. But it's more successful than anything else that's been tried so far. And I think the simplicity of RSS and the flexibility there is why we're seeing a lot of this new stuff happening. So I have a quick survey. I'm going to ask some questions. I want to see a show of hands. How many of you have used Delicious on a regular basis here? Okay, good number of people. That means I guessed the crowd pretty well when I was putting this together. How many of you use Flickr? Cool. Okay, same people. Look at that. How many of you use their APIs? And how many of you have written your own tools that use their APIs? Okay, that's kind of what I expected. And that kind of leads to the last question, which is, when you're looking at a new service, how many of you really want there to be an API there so you know that you can get your data out even if you're never going to use it? Okay, just about everyone. That's the interesting thing I see about websites that have APIs, is that a lot of people really want to see an API there. We all want the security to know that our data isn't locked up in there, we can get out of any time, even if we never query that API. And that's something that I think a lot of people who go out advocating every website needs an API do it sometimes for the wrong reason. It's not necessarily just because people are going to build all these cool tools that are going to remix your data with data from the BBC and Google Maps and Yahoo News and all sorts of stuff like that. It may be simply because it provides a level of security. You can get all your stuff back out of the service. You're not creating content that's going to help some company that you have no interest in. And if you decide to abandon the service, you can't get what you put into it back out. Anyway, so I went through the second. I spent most of the day yesterday at the BBC talking to a bunch of people there and gave a small presentation. And in preparing to do that, I was trying to convey some of the scale of some of the things that we do and the things that we have at Yahoo. So I came up with a series of lists, and I was trying to group things together based on the number we have. You know, there are certain things we have that we had dozens of, and hundreds of, or thousands of, or millions of, or billions of. And I made that list, and the funny thing is, if I made those lists and I read them myself in the right order, they sort of led to some other conclusions that really formed the idea for this talk. So the first one was, we have dozens, there are certain things we have dozens of. You know, we've got a few handfuls of bytes, well, supported languages. You know, we don't deal with every spoken or written or read language out there, but we deal with something in the order of, I don't know, 30 or 40 or 50 languages. And we have a similar number of countries out there that we're dealing with in terms of serving content and having registered users in those countries. It's not in the hundreds or thousands, certainly, because there aren't thousands of countries. Same thing is true data centers. We tend to try to put our physical infrastructure close to the users so that response times aren't much of an issue. We also have dozens of products and services. They're ranging from Yahoo Mail, Messenger, Search, News, Sports, Fantasy Baseball, you name it. We've got all sorts of stuff out there. But again, I don't think it's in the hundreds unless there's a bunch of stuff I'm forgetting about. And we also already have dozens of APIs out there for various services too. Now, some of these APIs have been around for 3 or 4 years already and haven't been exposed to the public. They've been APIs that were set up specifically for some partners to use. But as we've been exposing more of our APIs to the public with the launch of what we were calling YSDN at the beginning of the year, the Active Search Developer Network, which has quickly morphed into YDN, the Active Developer Network, which is our team plan all along, was to do it first and then make the rest of the company follow on. And this is something that's really starting to open up, and we're in the dozens now, we'll be in the dozens very soon in terms of what we're offering. So then I went to thousands. Like, what do we have thousands of? Well, we have thousands of servers, so there's no doubt about that. I don't know the exact number, and it changes every week as we have more machines, so it's even hard to get an accurate count. Well, so it's hard for me to have an accurate count to keep updating them, I should say. And we've got thousands of employees now. We've got something on the order of, I think, 8,200 or 8,500 employees worldwide, which is pretty astonishing. I I started when we had about 2,000. And we're almost four times as large as when I started a few, 5 years ago. Now, when I go into the bigger numbers, what are things that we have hundreds of thousands of, or even a few million of, that I can think of off the top of my head? Well, surprisingly, this is the kind of stuff that I think we're familiar with. RSS feeds that we're producing. We produce RSS feeds for lots of different things. Search is one of the ones that a lot of people don't know about. You can do a news search and have a news, and on the results page, you have the option just to get, there's an orange XML button there. As bad as that orange XML button is in terms of usability, it's there because it signifies something to people that actually know what it's for. So you can get dynamic RSS feeds from search results from Yahoo News. Well, it turns out that you can do the same thing for our web search, for our image search, and our video search. And we haven't been promoting this very heavily because I don't think the general population cares about getting an RSS feed of a web search for your own last name on a daily basis. But for people who want that, you can get it. It's there. And there are people subscribing to these, and the numbers are going up every single day. Yahoo News also offers topical RSS feeds. So we've got RSS feeds for the top world news stories, the top US stories, the top medical stories, the top political stories, and things like that. So the category-based feeds that I think are more mass appeal to the typical web user out there who just wants to get some interesting content, whether it's on their desktop and an aggregator, or it's on a website like my Yahoo or something like that. Of course, Flickr, which we acquired earlier this year, has been pumping out heaps of RSS feeds. I didn't even ask them for a count, but they've got RSS feeds for just about every view, every page you can navigate from the Flickr site has an associated RSS feed. Whether it's a group photo pool, a group message board, individuals' most recent photos, individuals' most recent photos for a particular tag, a tag across the whole site, newest photos, all sorts of stuff like that, that we're pumping out RSS or RSS and add feeds for. So that's easily in the hundreds of thousands, and I'm pretty sure probably in the low millions by now. The flip side of that is we're also consuming RSS feeds. My Yahoo, about 2 years ago, we opened up the ability to add any source of content to my Yahoo that produces an RSS feed, which was a huge change because for years, all of the big portal sites that have my something, whether it was my Yahoo or my site or my way or whatever the heck is out there, we all had basically the same model, which was think of the most popular stuff that's going to satisfy, the 80 or 90% of the population that's going to use this every day, and make these choices available, get the deal set up with these companies to add that content. But as we looked around, we said, with all these feeds popping up, and these weblogs, and these semi-pro blogs, and these political blogs during the election years, and things like that, there's a lot of stuff out there that people can't add to my Yahoo. We knew internally that there were employees who were saying, I use my Yahoo less and less as time goes on because I've got an aggregator now. Well, that kind of told us that if we didn't do anything about it, things were going to get interesting as the rest of the internet started pumping out this data. So we added the ability to subscribe to anything and anything that has an RSS feed in my Yahoo. And as a result, we're consuming hundreds of thousands of new RSS feeds that we can have before that happened. And also, we were planning to do an RSS/blog search interface, and it got leaked to the press about a week ago, so I guess I can say we're working on something like that. And, as you can imagine, we're going to have to consume a lot of RSS feeds to do a good job of that also. So in a sense, we're both producing a lot of this and we're consuming it at the same time. And again, the photos and tags and the tag range stuff on Flickr is all stuff that we're pumping out. Now, what about hundreds of millions? I can only think of a couple things that we had in hundreds of millions. It probably means I didn't think very hard enough when I was on the plane ride over here. The first one was queries. And of course, going from the search universe now, I always think of this as, we deal with hundreds of millions of queries, I think on a daily basis. I don't really remember what the metrics are. But that's the order of magnitude we're talking about in terms of people coming to our site looking for something and telling us explicitly what they want, whether it's a picture of something, a website for something, they want to buy something for shopping, or looking for a video, or whatever it is. We've got hundreds of millions of those all the time. And then users. We've got hundreds of millions of users out there, and something in the order of 350 million of them are actually registered users on Yahoo that got the Yahoo using the password, and got some data stored in Yahoo. We get hundreds of millions of users, unique users every month coming to some part of Yahoo to do something.
The numbers are getting bigger.
Well, billions. There's stuff we have billions of at Yahoo. And this is where it really starts to get interesting. Well, we've got billions of page views on a daily basis. I don't know if it's 2 or 3 or 4, or however many billion it is. We do billions of page views every single day. We also have billions of pages of everything else on the internet indexed so that we can provide a web search product. And we also have billions and billions of pages indexed to do that. No, I won't say how many billion we have. We also have billions of bits of personalized data out there. One of the things that's always been unique about Yahoo is we've had this huge array of services that have been offered, but all you need is you can come to one place, sign up, get user ID and password, and then start personalizing what you see and what you get access to. And that stays with you no matter where you go on the site. So the idea is we want to have these services that are fairly well integrated, and you can personalize just to some degree or another depending on the site. Now, of course, all that personalization stuff has to get stored somewhere. So we've got this user database, which is a pretty amazing system in and of itself, considering how big it is and the query rate it needs to sustain and the fact that it's replicated all around the world. But there's all this data sitting there that'd be really interesting to do something with. And of course, there's pretty strict limits on what we can do with it for privacy reasons, of course. We've also got billions of mail messages coming into Yahoo Mail every single day. Of course, most of that's spam, but still billions of something kind of. The last group is something I've just been starting to call the 3 R's, which is ratings, reviews, and related metadata. This is content, if you want to call it content, this is content or data or information that those millions of people that come to Yahoo every single day are producing, sometimes implicitly, sometimes explicitly, just as a result of their actions dealing with stuff online, whether it's our music service, whether it's movies or photos or Flickr or anything like that. And this stuff is all accumulating out there on Yahoo, and also out there on the web. There are lots of other services that are seeing the same thing happen, where you start to enable social activity on a website. You start to let people form communities, let them talk about things, let them rate things, let them produce lists, and suddenly you start producing these mounds and mounds of data out there. And the same thing's happening here, and it's happening on many, many other sites. So there's this huge growth in what we're thinking about is sort of user-generated content, and I think it's being fueled by several different things, and some of them are incredibly obvious. One of them is just the increase in connectivity. I was chatting with some folks yesterday about what the broadband situation is like here in the UK, because I remember hearing a couple years ago it was kind of pathetic, and it sounds like it's getting quite a bit better now. I mean, in the US right now, I have both DSL and cable on. And I think my DSL line is 3 megabits, my cable line is 4, and it's going to be 6 megabits at the end of the year. And they're just upgrading it because the companies are competing with each other, and the cost for me doesn't go up. But that means I can have a fast, always-on connection. The mobile phone world is the same thing that's happening, where they're launching these new generation mobile networks where you're getting speeds occasionally that are as good as the first generation DSL we had a few years ago. And conveniently built into those phones is something, admittedly not as good as my new 7-megapixel camera here. But it won't surprise you, we've got those in a couple of years built into camera phones as well. So you see, suddenly people are connected almost everywhere they go, whether it's through a wireless network that they got at home or at work, or a wired network, broadband wired network, or just the mobile phone network. And that means there's all sorts of opportunities to create little bits of content, or grab little bits of content, or look at something. And more we're seeing people are turning to the internet first in order to do something. I mean, what's the internet replacing? It's replacing catalogs. You've got online sites like Amazon now for shopping. It's replacing phone books. It's replacing the Yellow Pages for trying to find someone to come over and repair your screen door or find a plumber to unplug the toilet or whatever you need. So people are starting to just think first, I'm going to start with the internet. And conveniently enough, many of them start with search. So that means search has got to be really good. And the software that everyone's building, all the new interesting software that I'm seeing launched online now, the small services that are starting up, have some social component to them, whether it's social bookmarking like Delicious or photo sharing, which was obviously what Flickr became popular for. I've seen lots of people working on mobile integration for sort of ad hoc group formation, review sites for, you can find all sorts of review sites for restaurants and movies and plays and all sorts of things like that. And it's happening, just more and more people are baking social concepts into their software. the realization here is that the technology is not really what people care about. It's the fact that the technology enables them to interact with other people. It lets us, as humans, be what we are, just social creatures, and do it in a way that's less constrained by distance and time than it has been in the past. So, again, the byproduct of all this stuff is this growing mountain of data that I think is best captured by, again, these 3 hours, range reviews and related metadata, which are these little. It's not like even blog post things are bigger than this, where you sit down and actually write out several paragraphs of stuff. This is the sort of micro content type stuff that's coming out of all these new activities. And so, some observations about that. I think if you look at where this is going in the future, this data isn't going to all be in the same place. I mean, the big names that we saw there, the ones in the web services game, that obviously we've all got a big market share in what we're doing online, we're going to have a lot of this data, but I don't think we're going to have the majority of it. We'll have a lot of it because we have lots of loyal users. But the internet is a really big place, and it's a really big place worldwide, so that means that this data is going to live in lots and lots of different places. And every new little startup or service that's being built now is building these social components into their software. They're starting to accumulate this kind of data, too. And one of my speculations or hopes is that this data will start to become more and more available to the people developing and other people. And we're seeing examples of this already. The fact that like we've got a little RSS feed that Flickr comes out. The fact that as a Netflix subscriber, I can get a URL that will be an RSS feed of my Netflix movie rental queue, and I can give that to other people. So that means I can tell a friend of mine, here are all the movies I'm going to be renting to Netflix. If you want to rent some of them too, you can. Or I can share those ratings and reviews with friends of mine. And some services, of course, build that into their model, which is what Amazon does, right? Oh, you bought this book. You might want these other 3 books, too. It's just one click away. God, is that ridiculous. So the thinking here is, if this more and more of this data gets exposed, and first of all, RSS or Atom, which, again, is that sort of the only successful mass adoption of machine-to-machine XML we have on the internet so far. Or some of the more complicated stuff will be available through the increasing numbers of web services that are coming online, the true APIs where you're going to issue a query and get some XML response back. And the third one, which is sort of a newcomer in terms of the kind of mindshare it's getting, is this notion of microformats. The idea is you want to come up with a semi-structured way of representing a particular class of data. That could be a bit of metadata about a piece of multimedia file, a video clip, an audio clip, something like that, calendar information, all sorts of different things, reviews, ratings, and finding a way to represent that in XHTML so you can either display it in a browser or consume it in some automated way via a search tool or some other aggregation platforms can pull this information together. And once you've got information being made available in really any of these formats, it doesn't matter because suddenly it's all machine readable. And it means we can build all sorts of new stuff on top of this. We've got all this new raw material sitting here waiting for new stuff to happen. So just for some more concrete examples, some of these are rattled off already, some of them might have them, but I just jotted off the top of my head the other day and I thought, well, let me make a list of what some of these things are that I see on a daily basis that are being published that I haven't seen people taking advantage of yet. Not in a big way, at least. But playlists is another one. People publish playlists all the time. I'm currently listening to this song, or here are my top 10 favorite albums, or top 10 favorite tracks, or whatever it might be. Just lists. Movie TV ratings, recommendations, whether it's something online like Netflix or Yahoo Movies, or even something like the information is captured in a personal video recorder like a TiVo. If there's a way to get at that and share it with people, I think it'd be interesting. Amazon.com, of course, ratings and reviews, blog rolls. Again, it's just another form of a list online, but it's a list with some implied meaning to it. These are people I trust, these are sources I trust, these are things I read on a regular basis. RSS feeds, of course, being the way we move a lot of this data around. Photos, the metadata we've got, Flickr, the tags, the notes, and the comments. There's stuff that's stored on your own computer, on your own desktop if you're a desktop, laptop, only kind of person, or this is stored somewhere else if you trust other people with that data, but email is a great example of stuff. There's a lot of information in your email activity that could be used that's not being used today. Like the whole craze that people went through and are still going through about social networking, what the hell's with that? Going through and having to invite all your friends into your network? Tim O'Reilly just wrote about this the other day on his web blog on radar.oreilly.net, I think. tapped into that to actually construct your real social network out of your day-to-day activity. And the same thing can be true of mobile phone contacts, especially as more and more phones are able to do things like sync IP codes over Bluetooth and things like that. The effort required in doing this goes down. And technology is waiting to be invented. They can start taking advantage of this stuff and building new social applications with it. So what would we do all with all this stuff? What's available? Well, the remix theme has come up a couple times already. I think that's one of the best, easiest to understand things is take some of the data that previously lived in different silos, whether it was in a particular company silo or in different device silos. Oh, this was in my key code, this was in my phone, and this was in my email, and combine those and start to build these new applications or services around them. Bridging those islands, I think, is going to become an important theme that just gets sort of louder and louder over the next few years as people start to do more authentication and web service APIs. I think entertainment's got to get a big piece of this. I mean, social software or social media needs to be fun, or people don't do it. You know, if you ask people, if I were to ask people around the room why is it when 90% of people with their hands up are using Flickr? Why do you use it? Is it because your friends do? Is it because you enjoy it? Is it because you're too lazy to write your own software? And there's a number of reasons. But usually when I ask people that, one of the ones that comes up all the time is, well, it's fun and it's easy and I get to see what other people are doing. And it just starts sounding a lot more like social human activity, a lot less like software. And I think that's where a lot of this is headed. Another thing to do is becoming more common too, is really giving back and participating in this sort of new economy of consuming third-party data by sharing what you have as well. I think it's no surprise that several of the existing RSS search engines and the technological features of the world also provide RSS feeds of searches that you can subscribe to on their site, which is kind of recursive and hurts your brain if you think about it too hard. But I think is an important model for people to follow is if you're going to consume all this third-party data to do something interesting, it makes sense to also be able to let other people plug into what you're building. In other words, instead of building just a service or a destination, you're also building a platform for other people to stand on. So what's missing? This all sounds great so far, right? All this stuff is out here waiting to be harvested, all this opportunity. But there's a few things that aren't there yet. And one of the biggest ones is some notion of portable identity. The fact that I have the same user ID on Flickr and Delicious and on about 10 other websites, I mean, because I've got a unique last name, helps a lot. So I feel really, really sorry for people with common names out there to try to get into a new service when it's been online for a while. But we have no notion of portable identity. There's no good way of representing my identity on different websites and being assured that that's my data on that website, that's my data on that website. And this is, I think, a huge roadblock right now. And there's the different Skip Networks is a company that's been trying to solve this problem. And I don't know if it's going to take off or not. There's this new OpenID group that's floating an idea of another way to do some build an open identity network. It's also very new. It started a couple months ago, I think. But I think that's essential. And until you've got this portable identity out there, the next three things on this slide can't happen either, which I think are going to become incredibly important because the amount of data out there is so huge that we need to be able to do something to make it meaningful, filter out the stuff that we don't want to see. So the next one is really having some notion of a trust network out there. And there's some notion of trust already in systems like eBay, which is a reputation system. But out there in the general internet, the only trust people tend to have is trusting their friends or trusting people that they know, which goes back to the whole using real social networks rather than building these fake ones up. But until you can identify people and their content and their recommendations, ratings, and reviews on other websites in a reliable way, it's hard to build these trust networks and put them to good use. But I think once you've got that portable identity, you can start on the trust networks. The other thing you can start on is coming up with some authority metric. I put foo ranking here because I don't know what it would be called, because I think it'd be different for our service. But we've got these today in the web search world. Google has something they call PageRank, and there's something we call WebRank. You know, the basic ideas are the same, and fundamentally right now it's a popularity contest. But the problem is it's a popularity contest in which most people don't have a vote. The only people who vote in the contest today are people savvy enough to build websites and to know how to create links from one site to another and what Ahrefs means and all that kind of stuff. that's a pretty small percentage of the population right now. But when the software gets easy enough or starts exposing enough information about the implicit information that people are creating, and we have metrics for things like restaurant reviews or music reviews or merchant review, there's all sorts of things out there we could be doing. You're going to need to know who to trust and who the most trustworthy sources or most reliable sources on different types of information are. And that's going to require different, I think each domain we're going to then have different needs, so there's going to be different ranking algorithms that are going to have to be developed, and nobody's built those yet. And the final one is reputation, which is, in my mind, reputation is a combination of three things. One is getting the trust and authority metrics right. And third is introducing the concept of time, because a reputation is something you build up over time. So that means tracking this stuff over a fairly long period. The app that Ben showed off earlier with someone who was taking BBC content on a regular basis and showing you what changed. Now, if there was a way for people to review those changes and approve or disapprove them or vote on them or something, that over time could turn into a reputation system where this is what the community of BBC readers thinks of this particular journalist's ability to edit their own stories over time. And the ones that are more accurate or make fewer changes as time goes on, maybe they get a higher score, maybe they don't. I don't know. That kind of stuff hasn't really been built yet, but it's going to happen sooner or later. So what's at risk with doing all this kind of stuff? Why hasn't it happened yet? Why aren't people pushing for it? Well, one of the main problems is that a lot of companies out there today have this notion of, they're scared. They don't want to give out too much data, because if you give out too much data, you're giving away your business. And the reason is that one of the main methods that they think of for capturing and keeping users this notion of blocking or data locking. If we make all our data available, our users' data available to them in an easy to export format, then they'll walk away, right? Well, there's a possibility, I think, that some percentage of them would, but if your users start leaving in droves, they usually mean there's a better product out there, and you're not doing a really good job. Or that your product is degrading over time or something like that. That was one reason why I asked that question earlier about APIs and whether or not you actually use the API or you just want to see it available. I think having that sort of feature available is incredibly important, because most of the people won't take advantage of it. But there are people who require it, and there are a lot of people who really want to see it there for their own security and knowing that they get access to data. I think there's this notion of the perceived costs also, which is similar in thinking to some of the commercial versus non-commercial discussions that happen a lot when people start to expose their services. But the thinking here is, why should we give all this stuff away for free? That we've got these developers we're paying for this infrastructure, our equipment, our bandwidth, all this stuff, and you want us to go give this stuff away for free? That doesn't help us make us any money. And that's true. There is a perceived cost there, but I think what people forget to factor in is some of the possible rewards that come as a result of opening things up. The trouble is we're not very good at quantifying this yet. The companies that have been early leaders in this area and have been getting something back from the community when they open up, none of us have done a very good job of saying what that is, and I don't think any of us have ever actually talked about trying to put a dollar amount on that yet. But if that did start to happen, I think more people's minds would start to change. And the last one is there are a lot of legal gray areas here. I won't go into what all those are. I think some of them are self-evident already. Most of them I put on the sticking point slide, which is things like copyright and DRM. I don't think DRM is going away, but it's still a major barrier to doing things with the entertainment industry, because you get involved with the movie or the music industries or even television, and things are really interesting when you want to talk about remixing media and things like that. The DMCA, which is one of those rules that we have in the United States, was passed in a stroke of pure genius. It has all sorts of interesting implications in it for having people cause you to do a lot more work than you should have to, because they think you might have violated a bit of their intellectual property. Software patents are also an interesting issue in this too. What if you open up a service and then someone else uses your data or builds on top of your service something that is a great enhancement to your service or could have been a separate business, and they go off and patent a bunch of the software and everything algorithms required to do it, something you can't participate in unless you pay them a license fee. That's kind of weird. But that's kind of the state of the world today. what can we do in the meantime? What should we be doing? I think we should be encouraging several things. One is those three things I talked about earlier: syndication, making sure that sites that can be providing data for you to use and for other people to use are doing that through RSS and Atom, or then using microformats like embedded data right in the web pages we're already doing today, and starting to expose more and more through APIs, and just getting people's heads around this notion of openness and the fact that being open isn't going to make your business go away. And if you're in a position where you can, lead by doing. Start doing some of this stuff and showing other people what the benefits are. I think more and more of this is going to start to progress the way it ought to. Looking at that huge amount of data and all this opportunity for building new stuff requires some people to take our leap of faith and demonstrate that being open is good. I took this picture yesterday at the BBC because I thought it was pretty cool the way that they're just getting the message out there. What the benefit of some of the stuff is to normal people. The finding the ribbon makes it share it, come and get it. That's something that most people can relate to. Or at least most people who were born in the last 30 years or so. I know a lot of people still don't have quite understand what the point of an MP3 file or an iPod is, but that's changing over time. But if you look at it, you talk to people who are in high school now or graduated from college now, and look at how they're using technology compared to how people were using technology in the same situation 5 or 10 years ago. It's completely different. A lot of the stuff that the BBC has been pushing for, that the Creative Commons have been pushing for, this is a shot of a Creative Commons specific search, a lot of stuff that they've been pushing for have been running assumptions in many of the people who have sort of. The internet has been around as long as they've been alive. This stuff is built in. There are assumptions about what you should and shouldn't be able to share, but people running companies and controlling the media today don't quite understand that yet. So that was my main message for today. I don't want to talk about that. I'll take any questions about any of this stuff, about Yahoo, about whatever, and